This episode of Revision Path is brought to you by Facebook Design. We talk about inspiration a lot here on Revision Path, so I wanted to ask product designer Earl Carlson what inspires him.
Honestly, anything that's not on a screen, I'm on a screen most of my day, so whenever I'm not at work, I'm looking for things that are well-designed or really thoughtful outside of a screen, real experiences with other humans, real experiences with other people's works, etc.
Learn more at facebook.com/design. Are you looking for a job? Do you know someone who's looking for a job? Then check out our job board over at revisionpath.com/jobs. This week, Buffer has a remote position available for a product engineer. Vox Media is looking for a visuals editor for Curved at their New York City office. Cast Inc. is looking for an interaction and UI designer in Wakefield, Massachusetts. Fall Creek Software is looking for a design engineer for Glitch, either in their New York office or remotely. Cactus Group is looking for a web designer. And Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts is looking for a senior designer. We also have job listings from Indeed.com, so head to the Revision Path job board at revisionpath.com/jobs to apply and to search for any other listings. Don't forget to sign up for weekly job alerts when there are new positions added to the job board. You'll get an email so you can be the first to apply. Again, that's revisionpath.com/jobs.
You're listening to the Revision Path Podcast, a weekly showcase of the world's Black graphic designers, and web developers. Through in-depth interviews, you'll learn about their work, their goals, and what inspires them as creative individuals. Here's your host, Maurice Cherry.
Welcome to the Revision Path Podcast. My name is Maurice Cherry, and before we get into this week's interview, I want to talk about our sponsors, Glitch, Google Design, and MailChimp. Glitch is the friendly community where you'll build the web app of your dreams. Whether you're into design, coding, music, or art, Glitch is the right tool for you. Start from scratch or remix any of the available projects and make them your own. And if you get stuck, just raise your hand and get help from the Glitch community. Get started on making something awesome today at glitch.com. Whether it's defining a branding style in VR or creating a voice user interface that actually feels human, Google Design is committed to sharing the best design thinking from Google and beyond. Sign up for great stories, events, and the latest updates on material design at design.google/newsletter. Again, that's design.google/newsletter. You can also follow Google Design on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. Did you know that the number one email marketing priority is personalization? I mean, it makes sense if you think about it. You know, you really only want to hear from the people and businesses that you like. And MailChimp helps make that happen with their robust campaign builder and a host of helpful automations. It's email marketing with a personal touch. Sign up at MailChimp.com today for a free account. MailChimp. Send better email. Also, this is April, and like we do every year in April, we have our annual audience survey. So if you go to revisionpath.com/survey, it takes about 5 to 10 minutes to complete. This year, for our 5th anniversary, one lucky survey respondent is going to win a $500 Amazon.com gift card. Again, one lucky survey respondent will win a $500 Amazon.com gift card. All you have to do is fill out the survey, revisionpath.com/survey. That survey is going to end on April the 30th, so go ahead and make sure you take it. We want to hear from you. We'd love to get your feedback. Now for this week's interview, I'm talking to Eddie Opara, a partner at Pentagram. Let's start the show. All right, so tell us who you are and what you do.
Hello, my name is Eddie Opara. I am a graphic designer and I am a partner at Pentagram, New York.
Now, I'm sure for listeners, they have heard of Pentagram in terms of the types of projects that you all have done. Can you kind of give me an idea of what's a typical day like for you at Pentagram?
I mean, it always changes. So I don't know if I have a typical day. I try to. So, you know, I get into the office and I try not to focus my attention first on emails. I've already gone through emails at home, on the train, And I might just, you know, type one when I'm in. And then I go and see the designers, my design team. We try to, you know, focus on what we need to achieve for that particular day, whether there is a big presentation on that day. Normally there is a presentation every sort of 2 to 3 days with clients. And so that's my sort of main aim. And then if there's sort of longer projects that don't need so many meetings with clients, I sit down right next to the designers and we discuss what we're doing as a normal, you know, creative head. You know, I'm not saying that I'm strange. I also like to interject my ideas by just moving my designers to the side, and actually I start to create on the screen right in front of them. So if they're having, let's say, not so much issues, but, you know, certain aspects aren't correct, I basically interact and intercede and start to work on those particular issues. You know, sometimes I sketch the designs out. That's definitely there. I have my notebook. But, you know, I can't help myself but to actually, you know, grab the mouse and the keyboard and go at it. Or, you know, the old-fashioned way of, like, just printing it out, cutting it up, and then putting it back together again. Yeah, depending on what medium that we're in.
So you really get hands-on with the design. That's really good. I mean, I think based on the size of the team that you have, that can be really beneficial.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I've only had one designer that really didn't like it. I said, tough. He wanted me to, you know, relay it to him verbally. And I was like, yeah, I can relay up to a particular point, but I'm actually going to have to visually create or, you know, draw this out. If I sketch it out, that's one thing. You may interpret it in multiple ways. But if I actually start the whole process, or you can see how I'm actually creating this. So it helps. I mean, fundamentally, majority of my designers, I mean, all the designers right now, do like that. They're totally fine with it.
How do you end up approaching new projects? I know that Pentagram does a lot of different types of work, but generally, what's your process when approaching a new project?
You know, I have specific sort of methodologies that I like to, you know, utilize. But, you know, at first, when you're writing an SOW, of course, in all honesty, when you get into the project, part of those things are sort of chucked out and or readdressed. Let's put it that way. They're sort of readdressed. And also the scheduling is also readjusted because those items are readdressed. So at first, you know, it's primarily making sure that we're, and this might sound quite commonplace, but, you know, talking to the stakeholders, making sure that all stakeholders are spoken to. So there's nothing worse than actually having a client that is hiding somebody behind another door because either they don't like that person or they don't really care about that person, as in, like, they're not part of the process, or they just say, well, this is the process that we have, and he or she doesn't want to be bothered. And I'm like, no, especially if that he or she is the main person in charge. And so I find that to be absolutely detrimental to the process if there's a person or people that are not part, that are really key and not part of the process. There's one thing that I like, and also my other partners in Pentagram really like, is that we need to talk to the executives. We need to talk to maybe even who owns that particular company, even if it's incredibly big company. We don't care. It's an important factor because it's really their voices that control how the brand or identity and personality and character really works, really resonates. And others listen. And that's a really, really important factor. So that's up first. Once we've got that sewn down, we start to move into a process of our sketching and discovery, a sense of research. And the way that we do that in presentations to relate to a client is really important. We try to show our research in a way where It's a little bit like building blocks. You're not telling a story. One of the things I don't like is to tell stories to a client. I may tell a story in a particular presentation in a large audience. That's always very nice. But I find them fundamentally flawed and overly not rational enough. I don't believe I'm a storyteller. I like systems, and I believe in building different types of frameworks. And that's what we're trying to do. We're researching to develop frameworks that are incredibly flexible for the client to utilize in any which way they want. And that's incredibly key. So the way that we sort of break down our presentations are very, very important. And it's like a brick-by-brick system, or it's or what we call an equation, that we create an equation that will always give you a solution, a firm solution, or multiple solutions, whether it be an algorithm that generates different things. So it's like a visual algorithm that, you know, in our mind, I'm not saying that we're coding this thing, we're just building it in a particular way that relays different structures that the client can actually utilize. And so from those particular solutions or scenarios, one can build a bigger, better identity or brand or design UI, UX system, you know, whatever you want, environmental, space, everything.
That's a really interesting sort of concept in terms of how you approach projects. It's almost in a very kind of logical, mathematical way. I feel like a lot of what I hear from designers about how they approach new projects is about telling stories, you know, kind of weaving this tale to the client to kind of get them in the right mindset, as opposed to what you're saying is you give them kind of tools in a way to let them iterate on concepts to create a lot of different end results.
That's correct. You know, if you stepped into sort of this huddle room with me and my designers, you'll find that I often use the term narrative, not so much storytelling, because some people really want to hear that. But majority of the time, it's really more me saying, you know, storytelling to me is a fictional aspect. It's like you're telling it to a bunch of children. Your client is not a child. You're also trying to do it for suspense or drama. That's not the case in point. This is not a TV show. And also, if you're doing that, how flexible is the end result over again and again and again and again? So do you have to keep rebuilding this thing? You know, do you have to keep on creating different storylines? So it's, you know, so it's like, you know, General Hospital, like an afternoon drama. No, I mean, that shouldn't be the case in point. I think it's more the term storytelling that is amicable for people to understand. But to me, I don't honestly believe it is, especially in this world that we live in. It's all digital, digitally minded. And so if you start looking into sort of very clear aspects and rationales of how to code, you know, the fundamentals are like you have methods, you know, Boolean statements, and repetition, repeat modes. If you look at something like a Boolean if-then propositions, that's an important factor, because if you run a design through that, it's like, okay, we designed this, but if this occurs, then it needs to do this, you know? And so there's a clear rationale, because that's the question that the client's going to ask you. Mm-hmm. They're going to ask you, well, that's all well and true, Eddie, but if we apply it to this, don't you think that's going to occur? And you need to be ahead of the curve with that, you know, with them. You need to, and that's the great thing about the fundamentals of understanding just simple computer science, or, you know, or just logic. It's basically logic. And I think we don't use logic as much as we should in design. We take it for granted. It's in the back of our minds, and we should look at it more and more.
Interesting. That kind of hit the math part of me. My background is actually in math. I studied, that's what my degree is in before I went into design. So that part about really approaching things logically and systematically, I really like that approach. That sounds really good.
And then, you know, people may say, well, you know, design is an applied art. So the highlighting term is art. It's a creative endeavor. And it's like, yeah, absolutely. But So is computer science as well. It's a creative endeavor. And so we're not saying that every single time you're designing everything like a robot, you know, without a soul or heart or, you know, or any character. No, absolutely not. You're applying that, and that's another layer that you bring about. But you have to make, this is the hard thing about design and or parts of graphic design or even architecture and industrial design, is that you've got to put those two elements together, the sense of logic and art or logic and creativity, and punch it. And that is a very difficult thing to do, especially in a day and age where every millisecond we look at a new thing and then favorite it. Mm-hmm. That's it. You know, so how much did we really get out of that design? You know, oh, it just looked good. You know, yeah. Does it really work? Does it really solve particular things? And it's really difficult to define these days. So yeah.
Now, Pentagram works with a lot of different clients across a number of different fields, of course, design, but also technology. You've worked with nonprofits, with education, with hospitality, et cetera. What are the best types of clients for Pentagram? Like, what are the best types that you work with?
I think this is a very sort of boxed answer, unfortunately. I think we're pluralists. We don't have a single way of seeing things or seeing the world. And thus, we should never have a single way of picking or being selected for a project for a particular client set. So that range is incredibly important for the diversity and the, you could say, the dynamics of how Pentagram works. So yes, you know, we have this ability to do something for a large corporation, an enormous corporation. And then we have the ability to go all the way down to the lowest point and be for that smaller personality, that one person that's come to us and said, you know, I've got this really great idea. I really like how our Pentagram works. It's a nonprofit organization that I'm trying to build. Can you help us? And we will look at it. We'll assess it. We don't pick everybody. Trust me. We're not like that. And we'll assess it with, you know, and it's rare, but like, yeah, we will take it on. And we have, and normally it's connected to what that partner is interested in. Mm-hmm. And then actually everything's sort of in between. So we don't discriminate at all. And I think that's what makes us pretty special at such a scale of being sort of like the largest independent design firm in the world. You know, a lot of people will say, well, we just don't have time to do that. And then, oh, there's no money in that. No, we don't. We look at it as a golden opportunity to crack our knuckles and say, okay, we're going to create something that nobody's really ever seen before with you. But at the same time, we want the client to be okay with that and accept it and be open. And that's really important. And trust me, sometimes the smaller organization you have, is a lot harder than the bigger organization. I mean, it's, should you be surprised? It's like, why is this taking so long? So that, you know, that's why we have to be quite selective. Yeah.
So I know when a lot of people talk to you, you know, I've done my research for this interview, and I feel like when a lot of people talk to you, they always talk to you about what it's like at Pentagram. I want to know more about the Eddie Opara before Pentagram. Let's go back a little bit. I'm really curious to know about your time in London in the 90s. You went to the London College of Printing, part of the University of Arts London. What was that time like for you?
Well, I was 91. Born and bred Londoner. I always thought that London would be the place where be born and die and get married. I didn't think, further afield, even though I always understood that traveling for what I do is going to be important and seeing different things, I was going to be important to me. But when I got to college, I didn't have what they call a foundation diploma. So I came straight from school, my A-levels, and jumped a year into the degree. Normally, you you have to, in the British system, take the foundation course. Everybody does, no matter what, you know, where you're coming from. And I was, I felt as though I was very lucky to do that. And they probably saw something in me there. I was on a course called Media Production Design. I do not have a degree, an undergrad degree, that is, in graphic design. And media production design is pretty much graphic design, but it's also dealing with art direction and to be an art director and the production of those elements and in different media. And so I really enjoyed it. At first, when I got there, I think there was about 6 to 8 of us were black, you know, out of 80 to 100, which was really quite high for being in Britain, trust me. Even though you're sort of like, oh, Gordon Bennett, you know, yet again, another a place where we're a rarity. And the majority of us stuck together, which was fantastic, in the whole course of graphic design and media production design, because they put us together with the graphic design course. You know, we really loved it, and it made some really lifetime friends out of that course. And one thing that sort of changed, actually two things that changed my life there, was when I met, in my first year, when I met a man called Nick Bell, who is a very well-known graphic designer in London. And, you know, I was super amazed at the things that he was creating. He used to be the creative director of I Magazine, which is a very sort of high-end graphic discourse magazine. Comes out of London, and I eventually actually became one of, I think, his first assistant, just for a summer that was. And he, you know, just the way he worked was impressive. The way he taught was impressive. The way he sort of relayed information, and he wasn't around for long, really. He was only around for that term, and for me, but he made an enormous impression on the way I would sort of see the world or wanted to see the world. And then the second was in my third year, I left Britain and ventured over 30 minutes by plane to the Netherlands to live for about 3-4 months in Utrecht, to go to school there, to live there, soak it all up. And at the time, when I got to my third year, I hadn't really designed much. You know, I spent a couple of things here and there. I had this enormous sketchbook of ideas, concepts, and it was all process. And I kind of love process. I love talking about process in sort of an artistic kind of manner and also in a logical manner. And I find that to be very arresting. But the teachers didn't. You're in trouble. You're having issues. You got to design something. You got to finish something, Eddie. And so I left for a few months. And Holland has an impressive design culture. Mm-hmm. If you have ever been, it just oozes from every sort of orifice of that country. And when I was there, I sort of met one or two of my heroes. One being a man called Gerd Dunbar, who at the time ran Studio Dunbar, one of the most prolific designed boutiques in the world. Done amazing, impressive work for many years. And, you know, he talked to me just for maybe an hour, 2 hours. And it was just his impression and being in his studio, talking to his designers, that I was sort of hooked in regards to how to design and how to deal with certain things. It doesn't take long. I was super excited, you know, and then I went to another studio after that, and I talked to them for the rest of the day. I was super excited. I wanted to live in Holland. Mm-hmm. And so I was gearing up to actually get my internships to be in Holland and potentially work or live there for the rest of my life. You know, I was like, well, screw London. but it didn't happen that way. So I returned to London after my time there. And, you know, I was going into my fourth year and I needed to work. And I just started to execute. I couldn't stop executing work, you know, from my concepts. It just kept on coming and coming. And I was really excited. I really did need that. And then I started thinking, you know, I started to get more interested in computers and computer science to a certain degree. And I didn't think I was ready to go into the outside world to get a job and before my degree was going to end. So I started to apply to colleges. I only applied to two, actually, the Royal College of Art in London and Yale University in Connecticut. And Royal College, I applied for computer-related design, which was entirely different from graphic design. I really wanted to go in a different area. But Yale basically said, we have a lot of things you can do, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's a plethora of things, you know, from computer-related items and all the way over to standard book design, as in making those particular books. And I was, like, I'm pretty impressed. I was put on the wait list. I actually didn't get in to Royal College. I was big gutted by that. I was sort of put on a sort of wait list. But I got into Yale. And at the time, I was still sort of huffing and puffing and angry that I didn't get into the Royal College of Art, which is incredibly prestigious back home. But, you know, my father and my mother's like, but you've gone into Yale. That's really, really great. So I said to myself, okay, yeah, you know, let's, you know, I've never been to America before. And this is 1994.
Okay.
95. Yeah, 95. I got to Yale and I was super homesick. I hated it. First year, understand it. I couldn't quite understand the process of teaching. It was more so about you being an author, as in like looking internally towards yourself. Mm-hmm. Design normally is like you're designing for an audience or you're designing for a particular set of people, and you're solving certain issues, challenges that are in front of you. No, the challenge basically is you. So looking, you know, it's like an introspective type of attitude. That you're sort of creating your own type of work. That was like, wow, they've just turned my whole 4 years at undergrad on its head, you know? And I felt a little bit broken in the first year, even though I, you know, I did okay, did fine.
Yeah.
And I remember getting back to London and say, you know, my friends came around to the house before I was supposed to leave back, to go back to Yale. I was like, I was in my 20s and I actually broke down and started crying in front of my mom, which is the stupidest thing to do. And I was like, I don't want to go back. I want to stay. I want to stay in London. I miss my friends. I miss the way that we design. And my mother, being a wonderful Nigerian mother, said, shut up. So she didn't slap me, but it's good. So in a sense, it was like a slap to wake up and say, no, you're going back. And so I went back and I had an amazing year, a really great year. I started to open up, started to understand the different ranges of how to design and all the different mediums. And it seems as though I excelled. And there was, you know, at graduation, which is really, really strange. You know, I was walking up to the dean, going to get my master's diploma, and he stopped. And he's the dean of the art school, and he said, "I'd like to stop for a second in front of the whole school of art, and I'd like to talk about this young gentleman." And I was like, "What's going on?" And so, you know, he talked about me and what I'm trying to achieve and want to go places. I couldn't believe it. And then he told me that I had won a few awards, you know, at Yale and also outside of Yale, you know, the gold medal for AIGA students. And I was like, oh, well, thanks. You know, that's nice to know. And my mom and dad were quite shocked about that. So I felt as though I sort of completed my mission, as it were. Uh-huh. And I had that sort of 1 year free as an immigrant. Had that 1 year free to, back then that is, to do whatever I wanted to. I think they call it OPT now, where either a student who's from abroad has the ability to go out and get a job or have, I think, 6 months to do whatever they want, and then 6 months to go get a job, and then after that you've got to get that visa. Mm-hmm. I moved up to Cambridge, Massachusetts. I sort of avoided New York City like the plague. Everybody was moving down there, and I moved up there with my roommate and now best friend, George Plesko, up there to a company called Art Technology Group. And they were working on some pretty impressive things. One of my professors was actually, two of my professors actually worked there. And it was, you know, this is the time the internet just come about, but they were doing different things in regards to that. And they were talking about affinity navigation. And then this new term had just come out, social media was just come out in 97. And understanding the idea of the collective mindset and the networking and how that can come out. And we were reading different essays from MIT Media Lab about that. And the owners of the company were two young gentlemen, Jeet Singh and Joe Chung, who came from MIT. And everybody was basically an MIT-run company. And it was really exciting. It was so much fun. And I started working in the innovations group, dealing with UI UX aspects and this whole idea of affinity navigation that is now basically what Facebook is. And so back then we started to innovate, and what the great thing about our technology group is that it started to integrate that technology into its product, thus it sells it to everybody else. And so, you know, to cut a long story short, I was there for about 4+ years. And when the sort of like, I left just after the sort of the crash in 2000 and 1999-2000, and the company had done exceptionally well. They made Jeet and Joe multi-billionaires. They were worth $500 million each at the time. I think they're still worth an exceptional amount of money. Didn't make me any cash, but I had the opportunity to do that. And I learned a ton about dynamic content and how to deal with it. I got a job offer from Imaginary Forces New York office. And Imaginary Forces is one of the premier motion graphic companies in America, in the world, actually. And I was super excited because they wanted to attach the idea of animation of motion with dynamic content. So it's, you know, the whole idea of taking imagery or typography and it's been animated, but at the same time, it's been updated. And so that, to me, was impressive. Of course, you had the systems that you'd have on Market Watch on CBS or sporting channels, that updating of graphics is actually kind of dynamically done. But it was on a larger scale. And this larger scale was, at the time, was the largest screen in America, North America. It was in Times Square, 745 Fifth Avenue in Times Square, and it was the Morgan Stanley building at the time. I was one of the designers on that project, and I was really, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to do these enormous screen-based graphic pieces that were impressive. It wasn't advertising at all. It was just pure design and also art coming together. And this was in 2001, and we were super excited that we were going into a new era. And then September 11th happened, and everything sort of collapsed. Morgan Stanley didn't move into the building. You know, a lot of clients had sort of stopped their ad campaigns, you know. And I had to rethink what I wanted to do. And I stayed on at Imaginary Forces, and which was really great. But then I sort of moved to 2x4. 2x4 is run by my former professor from Yale, Michael Rock, one of them. There's three of them, Georgie Stout, Susan Evans, and Michael Rock. And it's a very high-end boutique type of design. And I loved working with them, working for them. I worked night after night on really amazing projects for Prada, Brooklyn Museum, Studio Museum in Harlem, you know, Lincoln Center. And these were enormous projects, Vitra. I still think today they have the most impressive lineup of clients that you'll ever see and want to work for. You know, I was there for about 3.5 years, and on a trip to Argentina, it was sort of about time that I left. Michael had sort of felt it, and so did Susan and Georgie. And I was on a trip with my best friend, George, to a wedding of a friend of ours in Argentina, Buenos Aires. and we were just coming up with names for a company that we could start. And George came up with the name MAP, or the MAP office. And we said, we're super excited. We're still pretty young. I was like 31 at the time. And so I started the company. And I said, George, you're going to come on board. And unfortunately, he never did. He was still up in Cambridge, Mass, and still working for our technology group at the time. I sort of built up the studio to, 7 to 8 people. And we worked on a variety of different things, a lot of cultural projects for like Studio Museum and Queen's Museum, and educational items for UCLA architecture, did some books, and we did a lot of sort of real estate stuff to feed our bellies, we did some experimental work as well on our own and some for other clients. And I think this sort of caught the eye of one of my former partners here at Pentagram, Lisa Strassfeld, who's who I always call is the queen of visualization, data visualization in the world today. And she's really great. And she told me to come for a lecture, to give a lecture at Pentagram. And I was like, oh, yeah, I've never been to Pentagram. I know pretty much half the partners there. Some of them were actually some of my teachers at Yale, taught a particular lecture or gave a lecture at Yale, so I know them. I've met them at a conference or two. So, yeah, let me go. And I just thought it was for just to present my work and stuff, and also for the food. So. And drink. And so, my my team and my girlfriend at the time, who is now my wife, we all, jolly, walked over to Pentagram, super excited, had some beers, had a ton of food, really cracking jokes. And I gave this lecture and people seemed to really like it. And then the next minute, I'm having sort of a lunch with Paula Scher, my partner now. And she over a chicken schnitzel and a salad. I always remember the food that I'm eating. And she says, why would you like to join Pentagram? And then basically spat out my food. Didn't say yes at first. And the reason why was, this was a recession and things were hurting. And a lot of people would say, yeah, join, because well, join Pentagram. They're huge, And it was, for me, it was really like, I kind of just wanted to, either, it was my fifth year, you have a 5-year plan. I'm thinking about moving the MAP office to Britain, maybe making or getting another partner, reducing the size of the team a little because the clients, some of the clients had sort of stopped working because they had no money, because it's a recession, and go home with my girlfriend, now my wife, Sarah, back to Europe. And that was really on my mind. But there's one thing that I wanted so much, and it really was the idea of a larger community, a bigger host of partners to riff off, to talk to on a day-to-day basis, to talk about your anxieties and your situations and new solutions and build a home, And that's what Pentagram provided. That was the thing that made me want to join. It wasn't anything else than that. And so we're up to date. That was a lot.
Yeah, that was a lot. What lessons did you learn from, I guess, going from your independent studio at MAP to that you were able to kind of bring over to Pentagram?
I think it's that methodology I have, that sense of that process I have. We were, I'm still trying to hone it. Trust me. I started it then. I believe in it. It has screwed me around a little bit on a couple of jobs. I believe the process is as important as the final product, right? And even relaying it to another client, even if that the end result was crap and you could say failed, I still believe in the process of how it was achieved. There were so many things that you can provide for that. There's so many interconnections that you can just pull out of the process and start a new structure with. And I think I learned that from, the likes of being at Art Technology Group and also being primarily also at Yale. The whole idea of introspection and thinking about things produces different sort of pathways of thinking, and putting those two things together just, you know, slowly but surely trying to achieve one's goals in the way I make things. And if you see the types of projects that I do, you'll understand that some of them are weird and wacky, and some of them are incredibly banal, you know, or what people perceive to be banal, but then can be taken further and executed again and 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 again the way it's supposed to be. And so that is a successful solution. Yeah.
Now, a lot of designers, Black designers specifically, look to you as a source of inspiration. I can't tell you how many times I've been in conversations with people or I've heard from people, and the first name that comes up when they say something about Black designers is your name. It's Eddie O'Para. And it's not just for, you know, I mean, it's not just for the work that you do, of course. It's because you are a Black man that is doing this work. How does that make you feel, knowing that you kind of occupy that space?
It's good. No, I feel very, you know, if I could blush, as you know, I would. I think I've got a long way to go. One of my friends who was one of my teachers back at LCP, Joel Karameth, said this thing once, and it's pretty straightforward. You know, Eddie, you'll never stop learning or teaching. You'll never stop learning or teaching yourself. And it's this until the day you die, child, you know. And at the time I was like, what, 19, 20 years old when he was telling me this. And it sticks with you. It sticks with you to say, it sticks with you because, number one, that means that you have to keep yourself humble, right? You can't be a big-headed dickhead about things, right? Or what we call here at Pentagram, sort of like the, you have a black cape. So, you know, the whole idea that it's just you, you're the best thing since sliced bread kind of bullshit. That should never happen. That you should constantly have this sort of very open mind aspect towards your, the way that you work and the way what you create. Things like people like Paula will show you that, you know, she's going to turn 70 this year. And by gum, she's doing amazing work, right? So, and she's learning all the time. She sits right next to me. You know, we talk all the time. We're always having these funny conversations. And I'm learning from her as well, which is fantastic. And for me, you know, I want to sort of relay that to everybody else. You know, don't be myopic. Don't think that this is just, there's just one route of doing this type of design. Find those interconnecting pathways and go with it. Just spread your wings, open up, breathe. And I know it's really hard sometimes because clients keep, you know, pressuring you down, but that's where you do your own work as well. You sometimes you have to say, and I don't know if this is a family show, but fuck it, you know, let's do your own work. And you never know what can come out of it. You never know if a client is actually going to utilize that, the wealth that you've generated. And that does happen. If you look at all the partners here, we always have something going on. Other than just working with for the men. And that's the thing about Pentagram. You've got to do that. You've got to breathe. You've got to open up. And that's really, really important.
What's the project that you do on the side then?
There's one project I'll tell you about. I don't know if I'm ever going to finish this damn thing. But and it's really quite simple. This is a story I'm going to tell, right? One day, a client really liked the end result on the project. I did not, right? I didn't like it. Didn't like it at all. They got what they wanted. Checkmate, Eddie. Fuck you. And they were like, they emailed me, thank you so much. It looks great. And I'm like, motherfucker. So I immediately said, I'm going to do my own work right now. You know, screw them. I'm going to do my own work. And so I started drawing. I just started drawing at my desk. And I always wanted to make a clock. One of my partners, Danny Vile in London, makes these amazing clocks. He's super impressive. And they're all analog, right? And so I drew a circle. And then I said to myself, well, what if the clock doesn't have, it's not a standard face? So it's just a ring. So if you're wearing a ring right now, anybody, take the ring off, look at it. And it doesn't have a face. You can actually put your hand, your finger through it, right? Or a pencil, right? And so that's the type of clock I built. And I've integrated a LED strip inside it. It's totally embedded in it. And this clock can be controlled by Bluetooth on your phone. So you can actually utilize it as an alarm and also a light as well, a light source. So you can decrease the light structure and you can hang it anywhere you want. And so I said to myself, well, this is graphic design. It's really weird. You could say it's design, but I believe it's graphic design. I was just using the way I look at graphic design anyway. And everybody sees it, and it's next to one of the programmers I had here who was working on it. It's like a centrifuge. So the second hand will spin all the way around with this like line, a light of line going through it, like zip, 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 zip. And then you can actually see the short hand and a long hand on this really thin rim. And it's so funny when you ask somebody to tell the time, they can. And so it's looking at a different way to tell the time. You can set different alarms up. You can do so many different things. You can actually make it into a visualizing system if you wanted to, for music, all kinds of stuff. Yeah, that's what I'm working on.
Okay. How close do you think it is to kind of finishing it? Or is it just something you'll always kind of keep tinkering with?
Yeah, we just got the circuitry down. I mean, we had this enormous adapter. We got all that down. We got the circuitry down. We're now sort of developing the rest of the casement work for it. So it's going to be probably by the end of the year, I'll have a model that I can shoot, photograph, and then if I'm lucky, if people want, you can want to buy them, I can reproduce them. So yeah, I'm looking at light a lot and looking at time a lot right now.
Well, let's switch gears here a little bit. I actually have some questions from our audience. One of them actually is from someone whom I think you know pretty well, Kojo Boateng. He's been on our show it was episode 125. He wanted to ask you this question. If there's one piece of advice that you would give your 20-year-old self, what would it be?
Oh, my God. Thanks a lot, man. Kojo, I'm going to talk to him today. if nobody knows who Kojo is, he's one of my best friends. We met in undergrad. He's one of those young black men that was in that class with me. So I would tell myself to travel more. And then if you can, find out where Sarah Rosengartner lives before you meet her. Who's my wife now. So yeah, traveling is really important. I mean, I said it in regards to when I moved for those 4 months to Holland. It's the diversity of it. It's different ways of learning things. If we keep ourselves cooped up and siloed within this world, then we're not going to know too much. That's what I would say. And then smile and basically say, you're going to be okay.
What are you most excited about at the moment? I mean, aside from the clock that you kind of just mentioned, is there anything else that you're really excited about right now?
Yeah, voice assistants. So The likes of, I bought Siri, two and a half years ago, we started building a voice assistant as well for a school up in Binghamton, New York. We're taking all their sustainable data, heat, water, air conditioning, you name it, solar panels and all that kind of stuff, and combining it into a system where kids can actually understand energy usage. And we created an interface, you could say a visual character more than an interface, for those kids to learn. And this character is called Arthur. So it's a little bit like the Nest, but with a face. And it also gives the kids ways to ask questions about maths and English. And so maybe I'm wrong about this, but I came to the conclusion that UI user interfaces definitely going to be changing. They're not going to have the menu systems that we think they are going to have. We're going to go back to what people may call pure design, have different compositions or different faces that are incredibly ambient and interesting. very intriguing. And it was sort of like an aha moment where, to be absolutely honest, you don't need to be pressing something anymore or typing something anymore. You're just talking and you're giving back visual information in a very sort of interactive and passive manner. I thought that was totally genius. And I think that's where I am. And as soon as artificial intelligence comes in, dude, graphic design is going to blow up.
In a good way, you think?
Good way. In a good way.
So as I've heard you talk about, you know, your time in London, your time in Holland and everything, and of course coming over here to the U.S., it sounds like you've done, of course, very well professionally. You're here at Pentagram. I have another question here from Sella Lewis, who is she's one of our design writers as well as someone who we've had on the show. And she wanted to know, have you ever faced professional failure? And if so, how?
Yes, I have. Hopefully I can actually describe my type of professional failure clearly enough and how one resolves that. Yeah, I have had that issue occur. When it has occurred, it was really about not having the right types of personnel on my team. And also they weren't designers. They were programmers. I do use different types of programmers, and these guys were on my team, and they really were very naive and didn't really listen to my associate partners who were sort of working on these different projects. And it just got to the point where the client on a few occasions was just saying, you know, like, we really love you guys, but this is just not happening. You've sort of basically disrupted our whole, it was basically a couple of websites. You sort of destroyed our launch, and things aren't working. This is embarrassment. And that relationship I had with that particular client was, I think it was like 10 to 12 years long, you know, and it just got to a point where I think it was just pushed over the edge. And, you know, in my eyes, I didn't want to defend the developers that I had at all. And I, you know, totally submitted to the client and saying, yes, you know, this is our fault. This is what we have to rectify. And in my eyes, that was a failure. And now I do not have that relationship anymore. And they're very simple things that could have been done to rectify these particular issues by those persons that I will not name, but yet they just didn't want to listen to it. And I feel as though there was a very sort of clear divide between design and development, that they were two different cultures that were never really intermingling as best as I wanted them to. That was that. You know, I have had other issues in regards to aspects of just, you know, printing mistakes, not many at all through my years. And that to me also feels like a failure. But there's also this aspect of failure being good and learning from failures and never doing the same thing twice. And in regards to design, yeah, there's certain things that we've worked on, and we've worked through the processes. And to a certain degree, the end results were not what we expected. Whether that is a failure or not, that's another thing. But what we try to do is fail, you know, the common thing to do is fail fast. And so we try to prototype as much as we can. And now that's where we stop. We do not go further than creating prototypes for different clients. What we normally do is then we take those prototypes and elements, and then we move them over to another company that deals with, that specializes in either the production of those particular elements rather than we doing it in-house. So hopefully that's answered the question. I know that there's so many different ways to look at the aspects of failure.
What would you have become if you didn't become a designer?
When I was 15, I wanted to become an architect. And then I worked in for a summer, I worked in an architectural office. I really liked it. And then I walked up to one of the partners there. It was a very small studio. It was just me, basically me and the partners, nobody in between. I asked him, like, how long does it take to become an architect? I mean, I don't think I realized this before. And he said, it could take some time. And he walked me through all the whole process. And I just said, Jesus, that's way too long. I started to, you know, I think my mind rethink what I wanted to do. I just did not want to do that. And then before that, I think it was, I used to love Indiana Jones movies and I wanted to be an archaeologist. And then before that, because I'm Catholic and I went to Jesuit school, I think, you know, when you're six, you know, I wanted to be a priest, and you didn't realize that, you know, there were girls and, you know, and other sort of things that priests can't do. So no. Didn't want to become one of them.
Right.
Absolutely not. But I do have a very good friend that is a priest. Yeah.
How do you find the quiet time to get inspired? Because it sounds like you're doing a lot, of course, with the work you're doing at Pentagram, but I know you also speak pretty much internationally.
Yes, that's a good point. I actually used to do this a fair bit, and if my mother listens to this, she's going to be really upset. So I used to go to Mass on a Sunday, and, you know, you'd be listening, but you actually, in my head, I'm actually designing things, thinking about how to come up with different ideas. And to be absolutely honest, it's one of the best places to go, you know, like going into a church, sitting down, very quiet, and thinking. Because everywhere else I walk, you know, there's just hustle and bustle. This is New York City, and there's just way too many things going on. You know, now I have two kids, and you can't find the time. It's impossible. I think that's why I have to come up with an entirely new regime of actually thinking through ideas. You know, you have to think on your feet, definitely. But it would be wonderful to get that time back that I've lost to really think about the work that I'm doing. Yeah.
What do you want to see more of from the design community?
Well, the design community is enormous, number one. And so there's so many different facets to it and perspectives for it to, and in endeavors to be achieved. And so if it was the, you know, if I take the graphic design community, you know, number one is, you know, I know this is a very sort of trend word right now, but it's incredibly important and should never be a trend word, is diversity. It's a diversification of designers and a better understanding that of cultures. And one of the things I always hate is when I get a commentator asking me a question about, not from your point of view, but others, where do you think design really is? And you know, you talk about all these particular westernized trends and all this kind of stuff. But when 90% of the world doesn't really know what design is, you know, and we're living in this wonderful bubble of ours, thinking that everybody else knows what it is and knows what to do with it. And it's absolutely incorrect. So I think, you know, diversification of understanding and communicating with the rest of the world, diversification of designers, seeing more minority designers in positions of, you could say, power, yes, and say. And I'm not stating that because I'm on this particular program. I think I really do mean it. It's really important. And another thing that I've talked about, and I remember a few years back, I went to this, I had to give a lecture in Canada on design thinking. I think I had 30 minutes to talk, and I did everything in 15, and sort of actually dropped the mic, was design criticism. I don't know if people really understand what it is. And also the idea of design writing is important. If you want to be taken seriously in this world and actually have a historical document, no matter what, you know, this is where social media and Facebook are, you know, aside, and you want people to be educated, you need to know how to write. You need to also know how to talk correctly about the subject matters that you're dealing with. And I believe graphic design has a major issue here. You know, there are very rare personalities in this world that can actually do this in our area. And one of them is my partner, Michael Barut. He does it exceptionally well. He loves writing, even though he says it's very hard for him to do it. He has his own way of writing. And so I think that is an important factor that we forego as designers. We don't think that we need to do it. I think that we do need to do it. And it's important because people start to notice. It's not a sense of just perception. They start to rationalize. They start to understand what you're trying to say. And then they start to come to you for more answers. And I think that's incredible. One of the issues I do have are these sort of blog-type sites that sort of pop up, start talking about a design, whatever design of an identity or whatever it is, and they give a very short sort of summary of it, and then they sort of feed it to the wolves, and the wolves are the sort of commentary that you see below with these sort of sound bites of bullshit. I find that to be uneducated personalities doing that. It takes graphic design and design into the wrong areas. We need to think about it, stop it, and do something different, because it's destroying who we are.
Sounds like you're taking shots at somebody with that.
I've done this. Yeah, I did it in front of many people. There was somebody I did take a shot at. It's not just them. I think there's others that they know who they are. And we as designers need to wake up to this. I believe that this is a serious profession, which we can play and express ourselves, absolutely, but it's also incredibly serious, the way we communicate with people, and also the way we transform our lives, and relay it to others, and to be taken seriously in front of a CEO or a CMO. You need to know how to speak and relay information incredibly eloquently, and writing is one of those methods to do that.
So you mentioned, I'm sorry, you just started talking about some things there that I now want to, I guess, expand upon a little bit. So you mentioned, you know, wanting to see more minority designers in positions of power. And that got me to thinking, ironically enough, about the Oscars. Did you see the Oscars this year?
Yeah, I didn't. I stopped watching the Oscars about 5 years ago. But I got the gist when I read the newspapers.
Okay, so you probably know where I'm going with this. So Frances McDormand, she wins for Best Actress for 3 billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri. And she gives this kind of, you know, impassioned speech about, you know, need to see more diversity in the industry, particularly for women. And then at the end of her speech, she mentions something about an inclusion rider, which I think is something that in the design and certainly in the tech community has been around for a while. I don't think it's had that specific term. You know, there have been people that have been sort of, I don't know, I guess letting other organizations know that, hey, if you want me to speak and there's not this much diversity on the panel or this much diversity in speaker roster, then I'm not going to be available, you know, that sort of thing. I'm curious to kind of know, what things are you doing to kind of help out the next generation of designers?
Well, that's a good point. I don't think I'm doing enough. There was one thing I did, and it was by accident. I think it was a bunch of students. I think it's from Boise State, minority. Hopefully I got the name of the university correct. They were a minority design group that wanted to go to Harvard for lectures, to listen to the lectures. And they were trying to put some travel. They didn't have enough money for traveling, this group. So they put a sort of a GoFundMe type of thing together to be funded. And wasn't really getting too far. I looked at it, I was really worried, and I really wanted them to go. And so I put some money in, and they were grateful for that. And that's all I could do at that moment in time, you know, because they brought it to the fore. They brought it towards my knowledge, and it was by accident that I looked at this, and I said, yes, this needs to happen. And when I was at the AIGA conference last year in Minneapolis, a lady came up to me and said, thank you very much for this. And you know, I was sort of, again, the sort of like blushy type of person. And I said, you know, don't worry. I just really wanted to make sure that, you know, they had this opportunity to go to one of the group, basically, you know, apart from maybe also Cambridge, with the greatest university on the planet, and listen to some great, powerful people to be inspired. That's important. Apart from that, I've just recently talked about the aspects of diversity, of being a Black designer, and the empowerment of being one in a lecture very recently. I think it was last year, end of last year. And that was sort of rewarding. I sort of gave my sort of points, and it was about being Black, but also minority as in the aspects of gender as well. For I was talking about the aspects of women and what we've had to deal with through the years, you know, so I got different stories from different personalities that are in graphic design to talk about them and sort of start to educate the audience in regards to our needs and wants and how to be empowered better. And I feel as though those are the types of lectures that I should be doing more often. I rarely talk about my work and integrating my own thoughts or into the work that I'm doing that, you know, that sort of resonates. So as being a Black man, how does one sort of integrate one's ideals or cultural aspects towards social aspects towards the work that you're doing? And it just depends upon the work that you're creating for that particular client, if that's feasible or not. And it's incredibly rare. It doesn't really happen. So that's yet to happen so much for me based on the types of clients that I actually have. And I'd like to do more. Well, that's a failure right there.
Well, I think, you know, if there's anyone that can do it, it's you.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I definitely have been, I've had my head shoved in a hole for a while. And I think now, recently, I've brought it up for some air and I've looked at the landscape and I said, oh, shit, something has to happen. So, yes, I need to do more.
And I mean, when I ask this, I'm not trying to like call you to the carpet or anything like that. So hopefully for people that are listening, they don't think that I'm trying to like take you to task or anything, but I'm curious because I sort of asked the same question to Gail Anderson when I had her on the show last year, you know, people know of her and know of you in these kind of, I don't know, almost omnipotent design knowledge sorts of ways. You know, when people think of Black designers, you two tend to be the ones that folks think about. And so I know that I interact with a lot of Black designers, of course, you know, through the show and, you know, through other means and stuff. And they're always dropping both of your names as inspiration. And so I'm just kind of curious, like you all kind of have an idea of how much that means in terms of, you know, even just speaking up about these same sorts of issues.
You know, in all honesty, in my naivety, no, I really hadn't really thought about it in that particular way. And I'm very heartened by what you're saying. And it's sort of putting things in a different perspective for me, a different type of light. Definitely so, yeah.
You briefly mentioned your kids earlier. Do they want to go into design like you?
My wife thinks so. Thinks one of them would be. His name is Jakob. He's 6, going on 7. He has a particular eye that she thinks he'd probably become a designer. Actually, Paula Scher thinks he might also. It's just things that he thinks about. He loves maps. Incredible. When he was 3, and this is really, really strange, he scared his teachers by asking one of them, where does she live, in New York City? And she told him, and then he said, oh, you live on this line at this stop. And 3, 4, and she told us this, and we were like, yeah, he really likes maps a lot, and he likes directions and dealing with them. And Paula told me that she, you know, as you know, she has a love of maps, and her father's a cartographer. And she said there's a certain innate ability to understand how to draw different pathways and design those particular pathways and figure them out. And it's sort of cognitive thought processes that not many people actually have. But she said she had it, I think, through testing. And we've never got the kid tested yet. And she said, that's why I became a designer. And then she said, and I think Jakob's going to be one too. And I'm like, oh, shit. We'll see. He's a wisecracker as well, so we'll see what he becomes. He's only 6, and the other one, Yona, is he's only 3. So,
where do you see yourself in the next 5 years?
Can you tell? Can we say this in the next 5 years? You know, going and echoing what I'm just like. I never know. I normally have a plan, and then that plan doesn't work out. something good always happens. It's like, oh, that happened instead. Okay, I'll just do that. So I really don't know. What I would would like to have occur. I'm trying to work on this idea of language, like what type of the range of work that I do, but then within that range, how can I define a language that is appropriate for me to deal with? And that language may have different levels and layers to it, right? It's a work in progress. And I'd like to get within 5 years to, you know, potentially halfway of understanding that language really well, so I can actually be more eloquent when I sort of talk about who I am and what I'm trying to achieve. And I think this is very hard. A lot of people think it's they have it in the bag, but the idea of developing a language, I would say a pedagogical sort of package of studying oneself and relaying it to others, takes a lifetime, you know? And I'm always trying to observe why I choose the jobs that I do and then design it the way I did. There's got to be a pattern. And I'm trying to look for that pattern. Some people may say, oh, I've got that pattern when I first started as a designer. But I really truly think that's the case. Somebody like me needs to have that type of thing happen in their life.
Well, Eddie, just to wrap things up here, where can our audience find out more about you and about your work online?
My work can be found on pentagram.com. The major problem is it's never really highlighted as my work. We don't normally do that. You can go to the news section and sort of try and filter out items there. Pinterest is not good. I sometimes go on there to see what people have put up, and it just doesn't have context. It's just a whole lot of stuff, a lot of shit that's just been plonked there. So I would say that would be the Pentagram would be the best place to go. I'm a bit of a secret guy, and I don't normally put all the work that I do up. I mean, nobody really does, but trust me, my designers are always telling me, yeah, you got to put that piece up. And they're forcing me to do that more, and they're also forcing me to do more awards. I don't like awards. I really don't. You know, they seem to like them, and I think I know why, because they're winning them. So, you know, just Google me, and you'll find some videos. I think videos on YouTube about what I do and some presentations that I've given.
Well, Eddie Alpara, I want to thank you so much for taking time out to come on the show. As I said to you before, you have been without a doubt the most requested person to have on the show.
I really can't believe this, for real. You know, I'm very honored to hear that. It's been a pleasure, Maurice. You know, hopefully this all makes sense to people. If it doesn't, you can try and email me at opara@pentagram.com. Not for any jobs, but just, you know, if you want to know more information, I'd be glad to try and write back to people if they have certain questions that are for me. Yeah.
Okay. Well, again, I just want to thank you for coming on the show. I really think that you had a lot to say around your work, but I think you also had a lot to share just about who you are as a person. I think that, you know, certainly for some designers, when they get to a certain level in their career, there seems to be the separation between the personal and the professional. And I think that, you know, through this interview, you've done a really good job of kind of mixing the two. So people have gotten kind of a more well-rounded look at who Eddie Alpara is as a person, and not just as, you know, this lionized designer that people know about. So, yeah, thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thoughts of love are in
your mind. And that's it for this week. Big thanks to Eddie Alpara, and thanks to you for listening. You can find out more about Eddie and his work through the links in the show notes at revisionpath.com. Also, thanks as always to our sponsors, Facebook Design, Glitch, Google Design, and MailChimp. Facebook designers work on creative products that are used by over 2 billion people. But what's it like actually working there? You know, everything that Facebook designs is done at scale, so design critiques, metrics, and other factors are a huge part of how they work. Does that sound interesting to you? If so, then learn more about Facebook Design and what they do at facebook.com/design. Glitch is the friendly community where you'll build the web app of your dreams. From games to art to music and hardware, Glitch is flexible enough to create some really powerful tools. You know, they just came out with a bunch of new features and they're now out of beta, so you can even use it for work or learn how to code. The possibilities are endless. So what will you create today? Get started at glitch.com. Whether it's defining a branding style in VR or creating a voice user interface that actually feels human, Google Design is committed to sharing the best design thinking from Google and beyond. Sign up today for great stories, events, and the latest updates on material design at design.google/newsletter. Again, that's design.google/newsletter. You can also follow Google Design on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. MailChimp is the world's largest marketing automation platform. They support millions of customers from small e-commerce shops to big online retailers, and they support the creative community as well. MailChimp really gives you the marketing tools to be yourself on a bigger stage. Visit MailChimp.com and sign up for a free account today. MailChimp. Send better email. This episode was edited by RJ Basilio and produced by me, Maurice Cherry. Our intro voiceover is by Music Man Dre with intro and outro music by Yellow Speaker. If you liked this episode, then please leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. It only takes a minute or two. It really helps more people learn about the show here in the U.S. and internationally. It helps the show by bumping us up in the rankings there for design podcasts, and I'll even read your review right here on the show. Revision Path is brought to you by Lunch, a multidisciplinary creative studio in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, if you're listening to this and you want to hear next week's episode early, then you should become our patron over at Patreon. You know, now more than ever, Revision Path needs your support to make sure that stories about Black designers and creatives in our field are being told in their own words. So if you support us, if you support our mission, just go to patreon.com/revisionpath and pledge today. For just $5 per month, you can get access to behind-the-scenes information about the show, upcoming interviews, and so much more. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.